Hey, everybody. This is Doug Goldstein. I am in the very, very lucky position to be in the driver's seat today. I'll be bringing on in just a moment Peter Schiff. Quite an amazing interview. I'm sure you won't be able to stop listening for even a moment. And don't, because at the end, the amazing Money Tree Investment Podcast panel will be giving their opinions, which you can be sure will be quite diverse about the interview. So go check out the refrigerator, pull out some old leftovers, throw them in the microwave, and if you have some flat Coke somewhere in the back, you can crack that open too, because you are listening to the Money Tree Investment Podcast.
Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Okay, I'm very happy to have Peter Schiff. Peter is a former guest of my show, the Goldstein on Gelt show, where previously he spoke about the debt of the U.S. government. It was, in fact, one of our most popular shows, so I wanted to bring Peter back. Peter talks all about issues on Wall Street. He's been on Wall Street for many years. He's a very, very well-respected commentator. And, well, Peter, today we're in the heart of the election cycle, and quite frankly, as far as I can remember, this is one of the craziest times. What sort of effect should we expect the election to have on the economy?
Well, I don't know what, if any, the effects the election is going to have, or the question would be, what about the outcome? Will the outcome have much of an effect? And it's hard to say because Trump is a bit of a wild card. I mean, certainly reelecting Hillary Clinton is pretty much more of the same. And we're guaranteed more debt, a bigger government, and a lower standard of living. And I think we are headed for a major economic crisis on an order of magnitude greater than what we lived through during the financial crisis of 2008. I think the economy is in much worse shape than it was going into that crisis. The debt obviously is more than twice the size as it was back then. So I think the underlying structural problems in the economy, which were created by a combination of bad monetary policy and bad fiscal and regulatory policy, I think that those imbalances and problems have been exacerbated by the Fed monetary policy subsequent to the bursting of the real estate bubble. And so I think we're in some serious trouble. On the other hand, you know, Donald Trump, I don't think that he averts the crisis. I think the crisis is coming regardless of who occupies the White House. The question would be, how do we come out of it on the other side? And there, potentially a Trump presidency, depending on what he does, but we might have more hope for a lasting, legitimate recovery on the other side of this crisis.
Okay, so let's talk about this in two phases. One of them is before the election, and one of them is after the election. Talk to me a little bit about how the economy or the stock market views an upcoming election, meaning when there's uncertainty. Let's start with that, and then we'll talk about what the possibilities are afterwards.
Yeah, you know, everybody likes to say, oh, the markets hate uncertainty. Well, I think what they like less than uncertainty is certainty when what's certain is bad. And, you know, there's a lot of bad policy that's coming, and I think that's a certainty. And I also think that we are back in recession. I mean, whether or not the government is going to score the recession as starting late last year or early this year, or maybe even by the middle of this year, it's hard to say. But I think whatever we just experienced, if you want to call it a recovery, I really don't. But if you do call it a recovery, it's already over. And now we've begun the greater recession, and we're beginning this recession, you know, when interest rates are practically at zero, and the Fed already has an enormous balance sheet left over from the last round of monetary stimulus that we were never able to unwind.
So let's go over some definitions. One of them is the term recession. A lot of people would say, wait, what do you mean there's a recession? Look, the stock market's been doing well. You know, if you look since Obama got into office, we've gone up a huge amount. How could you be calling this bad times?
Well, the stock market and the economy are two very different animals. And a recession refers to economic activity or economic growth. It doesn't matter what happens to the stock market. Now, the stock market has not been going up for the past year. And in fact, if you look at the average stock's been falling for two and a half years. In fact, I think better than 50% of all stocks on the S&P 500 are now down more than 20% from their peaks. And many, many stocks are down 40, 50% or more. So we have had stocks falling for the past couple of years. So it's a little bit deceptive if you just look at the overall market. But the overall market has not been going up. I mean, the rally stopped. I mean, it was over about a year ago that we made the high in the Dow, and we haven't made a new high since. But meanwhile, oil prices are now rising again. I mean, we're now above $48 a barrel. This is the highest prices have been all year. And they're pretty much going up almost every day. And so this is not a good sign for the consumer who was kind of relying on the cheap gasoline prices to help him deal with higher rents and higher insurance, health insurance in particular, and other costs, food costs that were going up. But now you have rising gas prices. The price of gold's been strong this year. Gold's up, what, 17% or so on the year. Gold stocks, you know, pretty much doubled so far this year. So where you are seeing strength in the stock market, it's not where you'd want to see it if you believed in the economy. You don't want to see the NASDAQ down 5% year to date and gold stocks doubling. That's probably not a good sign if you want to look to the stock market. But, you know, the stock market was very strong up through 2007, you know, even though we were setting ourselves up for a meltdown, you know, in 2008 and the worst recession since the Great Depression. The stock market did not do a very good job of forecasting that recession. In fact, neither did the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve did not believe a recession was coming. Even as late as mid-2008, they still had no recession in their forecast, even though the recession had started 7 months prior, and they still didn't know it was coming, even though we were in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's break this down. One of the issues you mentioned was low interest rates. The other one you touched on was the price of oil. And it seems that the way that people talk about the price of oil and the expectations they have doesn't always play out. For example, when oil prices were dropping and dropping and dropping and the market was dropping, everyone said, well, because the price of oil is dropping, so the market's dropping. On the other hand, you would have thought, like you just said a minute ago, well, if oil is low, that makes the price of gasoline low and it's easy for the economy to get going because you don't have the oil tax going on. But now the opposite, you're saying rates are going up. So which is it? Do we want a low oil price or a high oil price?
Well, we definitely want a low oil price unless you've got a lot of oil that you're looking to sell. So if you're a producer, you know, if you, you know, are an oil company, you obviously want high oil prices. But the typical American doesn't own an oil well, but he buys gasoline on a regular basis. And so we want lower oil prices. But the whole time that the oil price was dropping and the stock market was dropping, it was just a coincidence. It wasn't that one was causing the other. It wasn't that the low oil price was what was hurting the stock market. I mean, it hurt oil stocks, that's for sure, but it didn't hurt technology stocks. I mean, you can't blame a drop in tech stocks or retailers. You know, some of the weakest stocks were the retailers, and those are the stocks that you would think would benefit the most from cheap gas because it relieves their customers of the expense, and now the money is freed up to buy other things. So it was hard for Wall Street, although they did it, but it didn't make any sense to blame a collapse in big retailers on cheap gasoline when they would be some of the biggest beneficiaries of cheap gasoline. So what was actually happening was that the economy was weakening and the Fed was threatening to raise interest rates. And it was the idea of a slower economy, a tighter monetary policy that was causing both the stock market and the oil market to go down together. It wasn't that one was causing the other. They were both reacting to the same thing. But now, right, the oil market is starting to rise because the markets are now starting to price away some of those rate hikes, and the dollar is now weakening. The dollar had its weakest quarter in 5 years in the first quarter. So a weak dollar and the Fed not hiking rates as much as people thought, that is causing the dollar to go down, and that is causing the gold price, or rather the oil price too, to go up. But corporate earnings are under a lot of pressure because the only reason that theoretically the Fed is not raising rates is because the economy is too weak to allow it. And part of the problem with a weak economy is weak earnings. So now you have the stock market caught between two counterbalancing forces. You have one, more cheap money or fewer rate hikes, which is supportive of the markets because of the extra liquidity. But then you have the reality that the reason the Fed is not hiking rates is because the economy is much weaker than they thought. And if the economy is weaker, so are corporate earnings.
Mm-hmm. Let's break this down even further, because now you've been talking about low rates and you also mentioned a weak dollar. So there are certainly those people who would say that a weak dollar ultimately is very good for the United States and will help us to get out of a recession and will help the stock market because it means that people can export the goods to sell them all over the world, whereas a very strong dollar is going to prohibit that. And at the same time, with interest rates really continuing to be very low and the Fed not seeming to be interested in raising them much at all, it seems that this is going to make cheap money available, and that liquidity is certainly what seems to be able to help fuel the economy.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, it fuels inflation. It fuels malinvestments and speculation, but it actually inhibits real economic growth. Look, a weak dollar doesn't help our exports because we don't have a lot to export. I mean, what a weak dollar does is it increases the cost of our imports, and it means that we have to export more to pay for our imports. But since we can't do that, we end up with even bigger trade deficits with a weaker dollar than when we have a stronger dollar. And that's been the recent history of the United States. As the dollar goes down, our trade deficits get worse. They don't get better. Our trade deficits were the largest in history in mid-2008 when the dollar was the lowest in history. And if I'm correct and the dollar does continue to fall, it's just going to make our trade deficits bigger and bigger and bigger because we're going to have to pay more and more money for all the things that we import because we do not have the capacity to produce those things domestically because the industries no longer exist. The plant and equipment is no longer here. The skilled workers are no longer here. You know, we're just importing. We don't have the products to export. That's one of the problems with Donald Trump's let's just build some walls and have some tariffs. That's not going to do anything to bring back our jobs because the industries that used to employ the workers are no longer here. They're no longer viable. They've been dismantled over the generations because of all the high taxes and high regulation. All this activity now takes place outside the United States, and we rely on the strong dollar to import all the things that we don't produce ourselves. And as the dollar weakens, it becomes harder and harder for Americans to live beyond their means because the secret to that is the ability to take print money and export it to buy real goods. And as the dollar goes down, that becomes more and more difficult to do.
Are people feeling the inflation that you mentioned before, or does it seem, because the numbers that come out of the government don't seem to be terribly inflationary at this point?
Well, first of all, considering how weak the economy is, if you look at the weakness of economic growth, there's still positive inflation. It's a positive number. Even the government numbers, let's say the government claims inflation is somewhere between 1% and 2%, that still means that the cost of living is going up 1% to 2% a year. Most people's paychecks are going down. You've got a lot of people that used to have a full-time job, and now they only have a part-time job, or maybe they have two or three part-time jobs. But if you add them all up, they still don't earn as much as they used to when they had one good full-time job. So any increase in the cost of living under these circumstances is a problem. But I don't believe the government's numbers are accurate. I think the cost of living is rising more rapidly than the government CPIs would suggest. I mean, you can look at rents. I read recently that rents year over year are up about 8%. That is a huge jump in rent. And rent is a big cost. I mean, for most people, that's their biggest expense. I mean, maybe if taxes could be their biggest, if you add Social Security taxes, state taxes, federal taxes, but not counting taxes, that's probably number one. Now, your second biggest expense was probably healthcare, health insurance, and their costs are rising even faster than rent. So you got two big costs, healthcare and rent, really, really going up at much, much faster pace than the CPI. And of course, once you finish paying your rent, your healthcare, and your taxes, a lot of Americans don't have much money left. But, you know, food prices are going up, utility prices are going up. I mean, I don't know where the government is getting such low CPI numbers when so much of what Americans buy is, you know, a lot more expensive. And I know that when you poll voters, I haven't seen one of these polls too recently, but certainly over the last several years and last elections when the government was saying there was no inflation, the polls, when you ask people about the economy, poll after poll was showing that the biggest concern that voters had was rising prices. And that doesn't seem to make sense. If there's no inflation, why would rising prices be so predominant in the concerns that typical people have? And, you know, I think one of the reasons, too, that people like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are so popular is because the economy is much worse than the government reports. Because if things really were as good as Obama claims or as Janet Yellen claims, I don't think Bernie Sanders would be getting so many votes. And I don't think Donald Trump would have won the Republican nomination or be the presumptive nominee if the voters were more satisfied with the career politicians and the status quo. The fact that voters on both sides of the aisle are so desperate for anything different, whether it's a populist or a socialist, is an indication that they know things are bad. Because if they were satisfied, if things were good, they wouldn't want to take a chance on screwing it up. It's only because things are so bad that they're willing to try anything.
All right, so Peter, let's swing back around because you brought this all around back to the elections. And tell me, if you get a call from either Hillary or Trump asking you to be an advisor on the economy, what would be the top thing that you would suggest that they do in their first 100 days?
Well, first of all, I'm not expecting such a call.
Now, I can arrange it, so I'm well connected.
If one of them called me, I would assume that it was some kind of a joke. But I mean, I suppose that Trump is probably more likely to make such a call than Hillary. I mean, I can't imagine Hillary Clinton under any circumstances caring what I have to say, given the huge gulf between us when it comes to policy and politics.
Okay, but let's assume we're all open-minded and we're having a discussion, and you have the chance to give your two cents for the number one step that one of these people should take as the new president in order to change America to be on the trajectory that, as you're describing, would hopefully get us out of the mess.
Yeah, well, you know, I believe that Trump's idea of making America great again, and I would like America to be great again, but that recognizes the acknowledgement that we are no longer great, and we're not, and we haven't been great for a long time. But in order for America to be great again, we have to understand why America became so great in the first place, and why America today is so different from that America. And the America that became great was the America that was created by our founding fathers and the principles that were in the Constitution. And these are principles of limited government, of, you know, individual sovereignty, of the rugged individual, of government simply there to protect private property against people who would steal from you or attack you. So the government was really this there to stop people from doing bad things. But it wasn't there to, you know, redistribute wealth or to provide safety nets or to micromanage the economy and for politicians to decide this is what we think we should have or this is what we should have and we should take money from this person and give it to that person or have all these programs. That was not the kind of country. We had a minimal government that did very, very little, and we relied on the individual. We had maximum freedom and minimal government. We had sound money. We were on a gold standard, and we thrived and we prospered. And America built a society wealthier than anything that had existed in history. We built a middle class that was really a concept that wasn't even known prior to America. I mean, there was just rich people and everybody else. And we created a society where everybody benefited from the hard work of the individual, of the entrepreneur. You know, everybody's pursuing their own self-interest. It was the Adam Smith invisible hand on a grand stage, and it really proved to work beautifully. And we had this really great, wealthy society. But we destroyed that. We destroyed that with government. We destroyed that by minimizing individual liberty and now maximizing government, having all sorts of decisions made by government. We went away from honest money to centrally planned paper money. And it's a disaster what the Federal Reserve has done. And we have this enormous government in Washington that is spending a fortune and regulating, and it's got its tentacles in just about everything that we do. And it's very difficult for people to succeed and prosper. It's very hard to hire people in America now. I mean, the government has made that very difficult. It's very difficult for people to succeed and start their own businesses. It's not that it's impossible. It's just that the bar to do that successfully has been lifted so high now, thanks to government. It used to be much lower, and it was much easier to succeed. So we need to start rolling back government. I mean, all these big grandiose plans about what government can do, government is a complete failure. We need to undo all the terrible things that government has done. We were in much better shape 100 years ago before we had all these rules and regulations. So we need to try to recreate the America of the past. Right. And I'm not talking about going back to slavery. Right. We don't have to go back far. But, you know, we can go back to around 1900. You know,
I know. Would you want to live in 1900 or would you want to live in today?
Well, I mean, obviously, look, I don't want 1900 technology. I want 1900 freedom. Right. I want the liberty and the freedom that my grandparents had when they arrived in this country. But I don't want to give up the benefits of 100 years of progress that has been made despite big government. And the interesting thing is, if you ever try to think about this, imagine what 21st century America would look like in 2016. Imagine what this country would look like had we maintained the level of government that we had in 1900 consistently throughout the last century. Imagine the progress that would have been made that wasn't made. Imagine the things that we would have today that we don't have. You know, I remember when I was a little kid, I don't know how old you are, but you ever watch The Jetsons?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so The Jetsons was made in the 1960s. People were just assuming that the type of progress that had been ongoing would continue into the Jetson future. And in the Jetson future, not only did Jane not have a job, right? Because they couldn't even foresee women working in the 1960s. I mean, why would a married woman with children work? Because her husband had a job. But not only did Jane not work, but George barely worked. I remember George complained that the 3-day work weeks were killing him, right? It was like, you know, because the weekend was 4 days or 2 day. Maybe it was only two. It was a 2-day work week. You worked for 2 days and the weekends were 5 days because they just assumed that the progress would continue where we continue to automate and mechanize. And so that the need to work would be smaller and smaller and smaller. And our standard living would keep going up and there was all these gadgets. I mean, I think that I don't know that we would have flying cars and all those kind of things, but I do believe that had we stayed on our trajectory that we were on, yes, you know, we wouldn't have married women with children working and men wouldn't be working 2 or 3 jobs. They'd have one decent job and they'd probably work fewer hours and people would retire a lot earlier. People would have a lot of savings. We'd have a much higher standard of living. And who knows what extra inventions we would have come up with had we had less government. Who knows what diseases we would have cured if we didn't have the FDA. If the government didn't make it so expensive to develop cures, maybe we would have cured cancer by now. Who knows? We don't know. But I think we would have a much higher standard of living. But when people say, oh, Peter wants to go back to the 1900s. No, I want to have, I want air conditioning. I like computers and I like a cell phone. I like indoor plumbing. And, you know, I like these things. So I don't want to give them up. But I'd like to have my freedom, too. And then we could be a lot more prosperous.
So that is what Peter Schiff would say to Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton as president. Listen, Peter, I will be sure to send them that monologue so they have it and they can use it as they like to prepare their election speeches.
Yeah, one more thing, though. They have to prepare the American public for some pain, right? Just like, you know, if you're going to go up to a drug addict and say, okay, what advice are you going to give a drug addict, right? Well, it's you got to stop doing drugs. And so the advice is not to, you know, do more drugs so you don't have to deal with the pain of withdrawal or, you know, having to, you know, go through a rehab. So that's what they have to prepare America for, because we're like a gigantic drug addict and we're addicted to cheap money and big government. And it's a very, very debilitating habit. And if we don't kick the habit soon, we're going to overdose on this stuff. So I'd rather do it voluntarily because we check ourselves into rehab, then we get dragged in there by our foreign creditors because we have a dollar crisis, which unfortunately is where the situation is headed. So people have to level with the American public and tell them how screwed up we are and what really needs to be done. And it's not, you know, something from government. The government cannot solve our problems. The government is our problem. What the government has to do is extricate itself from the economy, remove itself. We need to massively dismantle much of government. And that means a lot of people who are getting checks from government are going to have to be told, you're not getting that check. And, you know, when Donald Trump says something like, oh, I'm not going to touch Social Security. We need to touch Social Security because we can't afford to keep taxing young people to give money to older people, especially when the older people are wealthier than the younger people who are being taxed. And the young people who are being taxed can't afford to pay these taxes. They can barely get out of their parents' basements, let alone handle their student loan debt. They can't pay Social Security taxes so their grandparents can play golf. So we're going to have to level the American public, let them know how broke we are, and that people have to rely on themselves. They can't rely on the government. They can't rely on some type of program. And the solution is not a program. There are no, it's getting rid of the programs and letting the people find their own solutions. Unfortunately, the problems that were made by government.
All right, so we will have to look for that, and we will have to spread the word to the people who are living in their parents' basement and the drug addicts. Peter, tell us, how can those folks listening to us today learn more about your ideas and follow you?
Well, I'm all over the internet. You know, I do my own podcast, The Peter Schiff Show, at schiffradio.com. It's also on, you know, iTunes or all these different places that podcasts are. So make sure and listen to that, either Schiff Radio or go to my YouTube channel, The Schiff Report. We post them up there. I also do video blogs on my YouTube channel. I've got a number of books out there that you could read, the most recent one being The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. And in fact, when Donald Trump talks about restructuring the debt or defaulting on the debt, even though he wants to backtrack. That is exactly part of my prescription in my book, that we are bankrupt and we have to admit it. And rather than taking on new debt, we need to restructure the debt that we already have that is unpayable. And so that is part of it. But if people want to do something proactively to protect their wealth, because there is a real crisis coming that is going to bankrupt, I think the vast majority of Americans, I think the dollar is going to crash because we're not going to do the right things. And people are going to watch their retirement dreams vanish as their portfolios collapse and as the cost of living skyrockets beyond their ability to be able to afford it. So to try to do something in advance to both protect yourself from this and actually profit from these events, you should contact one of my brokers or, you know, go to my firm. It's Euro Pacific Capital, europac.com, EuroPac.com is my website. And you can go on there and you can contact us and, you know, talk to one of my brokers. And also, if you don't own any gold or silver, I have a company, Schiff Gold, my last name, SCHIFFgold.com. I sell gold and silver, and I've got about the cheapest prices online. So before you buy from anybody else, you should give Schiff Gold a call and make sure you're not overpaying.
Okay, we will put links to all of that at the show notes of today's show. Peter Schiff, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, my pleasure.
All right, well, that was a very, very lively interview. And I note that our good friend Linda P. Jones from Be Wealthy and Smart ran away, but is replaced today by a special guest, Barb Friedberg, who is from, you can find her at barbarafriedbergpersonalfinance.com and roboadvisorpros.com. Barb, real pleasure to have you. What's going on with you?
I am just thrilled to be here. So happy to talk money and economics with you, Miranda, and Joe.
Awesome. Miranda, that means you're here too. What's happening?
Hey. Well, just hanging out here in Idaho on a cloudy day, getting ready to pull out that leftist nonsense that I spew.
I'm not going to start arguing with you now. And Joe from Stack and Benjamins. What's happening there, buddy?
Wow, I think I'm doing better than Miranda. How are you, man?
I'm doing great, actually. I'm getting a lot of feedback before I've even spoken to people about this Peter Schiff interview. So let's dive right in, because I understand, Miranda, especially, that you are a very big fan of Peter's. Is that right?
I think Peter Schiff is a very interesting person, and it's always interesting to listen to him. I don't always agree with him, but it's always interesting.
All right, so let's talk about one of the things that he said. He pointed out that the government claims that inflation is ranging between 1% and 2%, and he points out very pragmatically that look around, and people are saying that, gee, you know, things cost a lot more than 1% more than they did a year ago. Is he onto something? Do you think that inflation really is 1% to 2%?
No. I mean, I agree with him about that. Because part of the issue, and it's something that a lot of economists look at and a lot of people cover, is that the core inflation measure that the government uses kind of excludes some things. And the things that it tends to exclude are the everyday things that everyday people buy, food, gas, that kind of stuff. So as far as how inflation affects real people in their real lives, I don't think that the government measure is all that accurate.
Yeah, I'm feeling that. Barb, why should people care about this inaccurate government figure?
Well, it's kind of an overall picture. Look, we each have our own personal inflation rate, because if you don't drive, then the cost of gasoline doesn't matter to you. So we each have our own personal inflation rate, depending on our lifestyles. But the overall just gives us a general idea. So it's not supposed to be a pinpoint accuracy for each Doug and Joe and Miranda, but just a general idea.
Interesting. This concept of personal inflation. Joe, how is your personal inflation going these days?
My personal inflation is kind of up in the air because of the fact that I'm about to take this expensive trip to France. So my inflation is way, way, way high for the next couple of weeks. But actually, Doug, I want to just back up a little bit to what to just who Peter Schiff is, because I think whenever we have any guest on, we have to kind of do a good job of defining. Like, if I'm listening to a podcast, I got to know the person's viewpoint. And Peter Schiff really is an economist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so as an economist, I don't consider economists to be left-wing people or right-wing people, which is why he talked about both of the presidential candidates and not liking either of them, just as a very fiscally conservative person. And when we look then through his lens, every economist that I've ever met, when they look at the numbers, they're extremely bearish about the numbers. And I have yet to meet an economist who's a happy-go-lucky dude.
Okay, well, I definitely think you're on to something with Peter Schiff. He certainly has a lot of negative things to say about what's going on, but you know, maybe onto something.
But I think it's important to point out that even though you say, oh, well, he's an economist, he has this idea, he just looks at the numbers, I think it's important to realize that every economist brings their own personal spin to those numbers. Because you could say, oh, well, Peter Schiff's an economist, and this is why he does things. Well, you know, there are plenty of other economists, you know, Keynes, he was an economist, Milton Friedman, economist. They all have different philosophies and different things that they bring to their own philosophy of the economy and how it works. And so I think it's important that, yeah, they look at the numbers and they look at the data and they kind of dive in there, but they also bring their own interpretation to it.
Sure.
So let's talk about that a little bit more. He spoke about this problem of the negative trade balance in America. And he said, or you know, the discussion was, it's because Americans don't have so much to export to the rest of the world. Do you think that is an opinion, or is he, as Joe said, as an economist, he's just stating the facts? Miranda.
Oh, we're starting with me. Why? Balance of trade is not my forte. No, I mean, I do agree to a certain extent that, yeah, we don't have manufacturing things that we're exporting, but we could be a society that exports technology if we were willing to go through the process of saying, okay, where are we going to shift our focus? What kinds of things do we want to export? We get caught up on manufacturing a lot and say, oh, well, we don't have all these things that we're manufacturing to ship overseas, but we are supposedly a technology society. So what happens if we start thinking about maybe boosting our innovation in those areas? Could we become a leader in clean energy? Could we become a leader in some of these other areas? Part of the problem I see is it's like we're always looking back and saying, oh, well, this is how it used to be. So if we just went back to how it used to be, it would be better. Well, we've moved beyond how it used to be. We've moved beyond those things. Trying to turn the clock back is a little impractical.
Mm-hmm. Barb, you are a former portfolio manager, so you probably cared about things like trade balance. First off, describe, if you can, maybe tell me if it's an absolute figure or if you have an opinion about the trade balance as far as America goes. And is this important?
Well, it's just one piece. And for those listeners who aren't sure what the heck a trade balance is, it compares how much we import versus how much we export. And if it's 100% to 100%, then it's totally in balance. If we import more than we export, as is the case now, then it's out of balance. But the question is, does it have to be a certain way? It's just one component that goes into an entire economic picture. And I have to give a shout out to Miranda. She was so on target about discussing, we're in a new economy now. We're in a new world. We're not going to go back to being the top manufacturer of, you know, clothing or machinery or those things, because there are other countries that can do it cheaper than us. So we have to look to the future.
That's what he said too, right? I mean, just to be clear, that's what I heard Peter say. Was that when we look at some of the things that some of the presidential candidates are saying about bringing jobs back to America, I heard him loud and clear say, those days are gone, that Elvis has left that building.
Well, it's true, but I think we're talking about one component of an overall economic picture. And the other thing I want to play off on, which was already discussed in this conversation, is economists all have different opinions. Look, Janet Yellen is an economist, and she's the head of the Fed, is taking measures along with the Fed committee to move the economy forward. Everyone doesn't agree with what she's doing. But clearly, unemployment is much, much better than it was 4 or 8 years ago. That's
again,
a positive.
I'm just going to touch on the clearly issue, because I think that as time goes on, a lot of people who were once counted as unemployed or looking for work are not even being counted anymore because they're not even trying. So these statistics, unemployment is another good example, like inflation, of a statistic that people can really manipulate, I think, for their own political gains one way or the other. Let's touch
lies,
on something that...
Damn lies and statistics.
Right. So let's touch on something that I'm sure we can probably all agree on. One of the things that Peter said, he seemed to imply that more government is hurting the country, and that if we had less government involved in our life, then that would give the chance for entrepreneurs like all four of us to actually excel and help build the economy. Joe, are you big government or small government kind of guy?
Well, generally, I like small government. I mean, there was one piece of what Peter Schiff said that I really didn't agree with. But you know what? I'm more of a personal finance guy. So instead of getting into the politics of that, I just think that as an entrepreneur, I shouldn't be relying on the government to do stuff for me. I should certainly take advantage of any tax breaks that are out there. But I think if I'm a personal financial, if I'm looking at my own little half acre, I'm just going to take advantage of what the government's doing and do what I need to do. I guess that's my pay grade. You know what I mean? Anything bigger than that isn't something that I don't know that I'm that qualified to speak about.
I don't know. You are on the panel of the Money Tree Investing podcast, so you are allowed to talk about it. But let's go to Miranda. Miranda, I think maybe I'm touching on something you might feel a little bit differently from Peter Schiff about.
Well, so here's the thing. What's big government? What's little government? I'm in favor of a medium-sized government, whatever the hell that means. I mean, seriously, you have to sit here and say, well, let's talk about, well, what do we think is big? What do we think is small? What do we think is invasive? What do we think is not invasive? I mean, John Adams said government is instituted for the common good, for the protection, safety, prosperity, and happiness of the people. He said it's not for profit, honor, or a private interest of any one man, family, or class of men. I mean,
that's amazing. You know that off the bat.
No, well, I mean, I like John Adams, and I quoted him in one of my blog posts. So I just remembered that I had a blog post that quoted him, and I went back and found it. But the other thing to think about too is, you know, we get caught up on the founders, the founding fathers, as if they're this monolithic thing that always agreed. These guys disagreed about everything all the time. They disagreed about the size of government, right? You had Jefferson disagreeing with Hamilton, disagreeing with Adams, disagreeing with everybody. Everybody disagreed with everybody. And we sit here and act like they're this big monolithic thing that created this constitution. And the reality of the situation is we had a whole group of founders who created the constitution as to be a bigger government as opposed to the Articles of Confederation. The Constitution was meant to be a stronger central government and replace the Articles of Confederation. And that's what it was for. And then you have these Federalists who are talking about, you know, you've got Alexander Hamilton talking about implied powers and the ability to, he expected in the Federalist Papers, he writes about how he expects the role of government to change as society changes. He wrote about that. And
so it's certainly bigger now, right? In other words, the role of government today is kind of huge, frankly, I feel. Myself, I feel it's very, it's very imposing on life. So the question is that a good thing?
Well, so I don't think the government should control every aspect of your life. But I do think it's important for the government to we've created a situation where we say, oh, well, we're a society now that cares about people. You know, I mean, George Washington talked about moving toward a society of liberality and justice for more people. And we're moving to that point. I mean, we're talking about the time of the founders. How many people were enfranchised with the vote? How many people were expected to be participants in democracy? How many people were, you know, we have a society where we've moved to a point where we say, well, we say that we want to take care of people. We say that we want to have some sort of a safety net. Now, do I think we need to have handouts? And we talked about this a little bit before when we talked about guaranteed income. I don't think that that's the way to do it. But I do think that a safety net is important. And I do think that having a government that has enough regulation on business to say, oh, hey, wait a minute, you as a business are imposing on somebody else. Because let's not forget that, you know, everybody's favorite guy, Jefferson, talked about how once the banks and the moneyed interests and the corporations take over, that's when we end. And so I think having a government that says, hey, wait a minute, let's step in and protect a little bit and help the consumer be protected against these big corporations and these moneyed interests, I think that that's important.
Yeah, I think the issue that we're dealing with is that there is a line, right, that you have to draw. And a lot of people who, you know, the people who were doing you know, wanted to help to whiten people's teeth, and then they were shut down because of the dentist lobby, or people who wanted to hire kids to work, you know, to give them a first job, and then they were shut down because of minimum wage. There was just a line where it was drawn by the government. Barb, tell me something. I'm going to ask you as a portfolio manager, because I think you've got kind of an investment.
My ramblings don't matter.
No.
I don't have any credentials.
Sorry, no. I want to know from an investment standpoint, when the government gets involved in trying to control investments and control the economy and control, for example, what's going on, don't we end up with situations like we saw in the early 2000s that led up to a crash in 2008 that you know, the government was intimately involved in handling the markets? It wasn't that they were laissez-faire. Doesn't that actually hurt us?
Well, that actually, the 2008 busting of the housing bubble and the subsequent recession actually started many years prior when banks were deregulated. So that happened, you know, many, many years ago, banks were deregulated. And then what happened in 2008, the idea was, oh, everyone should own a home.
Whose idea was that?
That's like kind of in the common lexicon of our country, that people should own a home, that you should own a home. So owning a home is a goal to be strived for within our society. And because of that goal, it combined with the idea that regulations on banks in terms of what they can invest in were loosened completely, many people who could not afford to make the payments on their homes were given homes. Okay. And then additionally, on the other end of that, what happened was then there were all these mortgages, and then the bankers and the investment bankers said, wow, here's all this cash. We'll put it together in these little packages. We'll sell it as bonds. And because there were a lot of quote unquote bad credit risk mortgages in there, which means people were going to fail on their mortgage because they couldn't afford to pay for it anyhow. So it turned into a huge conundrum. So the cause of the 2008 crisis is so multifaceted that it's hard to pinpoint one cause. But what was your question again?
He's trying to imply that, you know, government regulation and too much regulation was the cause of the crash, when actually that's reversed, because the deregulation that led to the way that banks were able to commix. Banks were, because of deregulation, banks were able to say, hey, I am going to take you, average Joe, I'm going to take your money and I'm going to gamble with it to try and make bigger profits for me. And
the banks were pushed, were in fact forced to give loans to people they couldn't even manage. The head of Countrywide that went bust was a major that really hurt the economy a lot. That's what the legislation forced them to give mortgages to low-income borrowers to meet the American dream. Yeah, so the government was telling them what to do.
Yeah, my friends that are bankers talk about that a lot, about how frustrating it is to have been told, no, you really need to give loans to X, Y, and Z person when they're a more conservative bank than that. And I mean, I don't know. It was a frustrating time for everybody.
So it's probably a combination then. It's a combination of saying, well, let's deregulate on this side and then, you know.
I think the issue is good intentions and, you know, the way things are implemented, which isn't just a government problem. It's the way that, you know, people do their budgets, right?
I mean, I don't think anyone's talking about the intentions. I don't think we're going there. No one wanted to hurt a lot of people.
Sure.
Right? But in order to help people, you know, it's like when you allow someone to buy something he simply can't afford, you're not helping him. You're putting him in a worse situation. You're putting him deep in debt.
And I agree with that. And I think it's too bad that part of the issue here was, yeah, saying, oh, well, you know, go ahead and give these loans. And then while we're at it, we'll make it easier for you to profit off of them with these, you know, dubious investment products. But at the same time, I mean, part of the issue, too, is once again, it goes back to what Barb was saying. She said, oh, well, we just, you know, for some reason, society says we have to own a house. And we all know that I'm not a big fan of, you know, home ownership. So, but the idea that society says, oh, well, and the idea that we kind of got caught up in saying, oh, well, if you own a house, you've made it. Or if you own a house, that's how you build wealth.
Well, and there is so much blame to go around that this whole issue. For example, if there weren't the bankers there who took these mortgages, bundled them together, and resold them as bonds with questionable underpinnings, then there wouldn't have been the demand for all the mortgages. So the bankers took advantage. The rating companies are significantly at fault because they did not rate this very bad debt or very low-quality debt appropriately. So people bought them, and then the government bailed out these big institutions, which I don't know if that's good or bad. You know, the idea was if they hadn't bailed out the big banks, then they would have fell and crashed the economy. So, you know, maybe that's a good idea.
But we're happy that they didn't crash the economy. I just think
right.
The question. So today,
but let's not
everything
forget,
is cool.
Let's not forget. They went ahead and let Lehman Brothers go down. Then their masters on Wall Street went ape poo poo. So
yeah,
sorry,
let one bank go down.
Right.
So
and then everybody sits here and acts like, oh well, Wall Street, they're these great, you know, whatevers, and they're free to do whatever. But the fact of the matter, and they act like government's not in their pocket. But here I come again. But
they're not. Wait, Lehman was not the only bank that went down. Bear Stearns.
Oh yeah,
away.
Some other ones went down. But I'm just saying, after they started going down, and after the government went ahead and let them go down, Wall Street went ape poo poo, and everybody freaked out and said, "Well, we've got to shore them up."
Who said that? The government said, because the government was getting involved where probably it shouldn't be, and let's give them all this money, and then they can have these big bonuses too.
Right, and that is actually my problem with the bailout. To tell the truth, what I'm saying is when the government first started letting these banks go down, that's when Wall Street went crazy and said, "No, no, you've got to stop this."
Well, and then they feel like we can do whatever the heck we want because if there's a problem, the government will bail us out and no one will be hurt except the U.S. taxpayer. But I think getting back to like the bigger economic questions that Peter discussed, there's no easy answer. There's no right answer. For example, Larry Summers, who was he was a former president of Harvard. He was an economic advisor to President Obama and in competition with Yellen for the Fed chair. He has been writing a lot about the idea of secular stagnation as a way to describe our economy. And what that's saying is the solution to that, and this is another viewpoint totally contrary to Schiff's, but his idea is if we got in and rebuilt our infrastructure in our country by using fiscal policy, which means creating more projects to spend money, granted that would increase our deficit, but it would get more people back to work, and ultimately it would get our economy growing again. So I'm not saying this is the way to go, but what I'm throwing this out is there's a lot of different viewpoints on economic fixes.
Yeah, he's definitely got the...
And I think one of the things here is to say, it's not just, oh, are you big government versus small government? Do you think government should intervene or should it not intervene? I think the problem we're running into right now is where do we find that balance? Because we do need some government to help us out with this stuff, to help regulate, to help, but we don't want it over-regulated. And I think where we're at right now is we're trying to find that balance and trying to find, okay, we need to find a point where it works well, but it's not too much. And I think that is, it's very nuanced and it's not black or white. We're not living in this dichotomy where it's this or this. As we can see from all of our complex thoughts here, it's not an issue of, like Barb said, a magical fix that we can do one thing and make it right.
So what we need, what we really need at this point is we need wisdom and we need someone who can provide it. And let's go around and we'll give our last word because we're just about out of time. So I'm going to turn to the guru of the discussion today, Joe Saul Sehy from Stacking Benjamins. What do you say, big or small?
I had one last thought, which is that I love what Peter Schiff does to our roundtable.
We didn't even get to talk about the gold standard. I think we need to do this again next week just so we could talk about that.
Nothing to do. I'm so glad I'm not here next week. I want to do with that. What I do want to do, though, is look at this. And I think there's things that we can agree on that he brought up that are important for our portfolio, which is really, for me, where the rubber meets the road. Is there any nugget in there that I can take that I think is valuable? And that's that government debt is getting bigger and bigger. And the true way to solve the problem is it has got to be some sort of restructuring. That's what always happens. It just always happens. When people or companies or countries run into debt, they find ways to wipe it out. So if you're investing in government debt is not always going to be as safe as it's been considered in the past. I think that's a true thing that I think we can get out for our portfolio on today's. I think we can all agree on that.
No, I disagree 100%.
All right. Go, Bob.
I think you are totally wrong.
Wow.
I don't think in the future.
Joe, I love you, but I believe that U.S. government debt will continue to be the safest debt in the world unless hits the fan and our country goes down, in which case, you know, we're all screwed. Yeah.
That's how I always like to say.
I think it's already hit the fan, but I also think we have people around the world that are great at that have become better and better with the books. And if all we do is continually just cover up the issue, take on more debt, that never ends well. How does that end? There's no way. And I'm not saying this is tomorrow. And I'm just saying that in the future, there's no way if I'm somebody's financial advisor. And they just, well, I'm going to use a credit card tomorrow, Livon. Okay, well, then we're going to pay the interest on it. Yeah, that's fine. We're going to pay the interest on that loan. And that becomes just a bigger and bigger part of their budget. What happens at the end of that? And that's not, we always get into these comparisons about U.S. versus the rest of, it's not about U.S. versus the rest of the world. It's about just having your fiscal house in order. That's all it's about.
Yeah, like Donald Trump as president, he declares bankruptcy and wipe out all our debt. I mean, that's the solution.
Work but for him.
You
in the
know,
past.
Joe, not to usurp this entire conversation, but Joe, the difference between you and me and the government is they can print more money, we cannot.
Exactly.
So,
right, and then that's.
Exactly. What might look, I'm not saying we should just, the deficit should go on forever because there are measures that need to be taken to dial back the debt. Absolutely. There does need to be restructuring. I totally agree with you on that. But the reality is when inflation goes up just a bit, we will be paying back the debt with cheaper dollars. So it will cost us less. And we can get the debt under control if we just rejigger the tax, the spending aspects of our government.
I would love to see that happen.
Too bad politics gets in the way, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so from a personal financial standpoint, that's my feeling. My feeling is government debt is not going to be as safe in the future as it's going to be as it was in the past. That's my takeaway. So,
all right. That's Joe's takeaway. Miranda, you get to give us your takeaway.
Good Lord. Really? Haven't you listened to me enough this episode?
Okay, you're done. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Next. No. Let's hear your conclusion.
No, really. My takeaway is, you know, it's about you personally in your personal life. Let's.
You're talking to me, by the way, or you mean like everyone?
Like everybody. The general.
Oh, okay. Leader. I thought you were annoyed with me for bringing Peter on.
No, I love that you brought Peter on because it gave me a soapbox to stand on and scream. But really, just look at your personal life and say, hey, let's see, what can I do to diversify myself? And so, to a certain degree, of course, I say, well, you know, I invest, I do these things, I try and take good care of my money, grow wealth for the future. But at the same time, you know, because I grew up where I grew up and because I am who I am, at the same time, I say, well, you know, maybe it will, as Barb says, go all to shit. And if it does, I've got my rifle and my ammo and my fishing tackle. And you know what? I'm ready because gold, whatever, isn't going to matter for beans if this really does go down. So I'm good. You know, I live here close to the mountains and I wasn't super happy about moving back. But, you know, if it really does go to pot, I'm ready. I've got all I need right here.
And you can grow your pot right there, too. Right, Barb, your last word for today. You got some fine words of wisdom for us, Barb?
Yes, I absolutely do. And I think I want to echo parts of Miranda and Joe's comments, which are you have to take responsibility for yourself. the government is going to do what it does. You're going to vote for whom you think will best serve the people. But in the last analysis, you have to have ownership on your own life and your own dollar. Don't worry about FOMO. You're not going to miss anything if you take charge of yourself. Don't worry about what the Joneses are doing. And just keep your own life in check so that you're not spending too much.
All right.
And that you're investing and saving.
Joe, we need to now mute Miranda's microphone because I just want to point out and not let her, you know, say anything that she agreed with Peter Schiff that the way inflation is handled is wrong. And she agreed with Peter Schiff that America has export issues. And she agreed with Peter Schiff that you can't give loans to people who can't afford it. So it sounds to me that Miranda's like a Schiff advocate. Schiff for president, right? That's what Miranda's saying now.
So here's the thing. when you think about this stuff, rather than just be stuck in your ideology, you can say, oh, I agree with you on these things, even if I don't agree with you on these other things.
Okay, so we're finding common ground. But Joe, I just want to wrap up. My final word here is that we all have to understand that when you have, from a personal finance standpoint, when we talk about the U.S. government paying off debt by printing money and paying it off with cheaper dollars in the future, that sounds nice on the one hand because they don't have to have all these dollars. On the other hand, it is a complete nightmare. Imagine you're working for decades and saving, like, you know, all the good boys and girls put aside their money and they invest just like they listened to on Stacking Benjamins. And then 10, 20, 30, 40 years later, you find out that you've got cheap, worthless dollars, which is exactly the direction it's going to go if the government has to keep spending. So forget the politics of it, but I'm just telling people, you better be very, very careful if you expect that the money you're saving today is really going to be worth something if you see the government continue to build up more debt. And now we can turn on Miranda's microphone once more, because Miranda, I would be very grateful if you would wrap up today's show.
Thanks for listening to the Money Tree Podcast. Go and visit us at moneytreepodcast.com and make sure that you subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. Leave us a review. Tell us what you thought about this episode. Leave us some comments. Tell us what you think about our various viewpoints.
Oh, boy.
That's right. I'm inviting problems here, I know. But go ahead and do that. Remember, moneytreepodcast.com. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.